live from historic Leimert Park in Los Angeles, California. I'm Tavis Smiley, and I'm so glad to see you and me back in stride again. Before we get started with today's show, let me invite you to follow me on Facebook and Instagram at The Real Tavis Smiley, and get updates on X, that's formerly Twitter, at Tavis Smiley. By the way, should you miss any part of today's program or want to catch up on previous shows, you can always visit thetavissmileyshow.com. That's thetavissmileyshow.com, or wherever you get your podcast, and listen to the Tavis Smiley podcast version of this live program at your leisure. Another great show on tap for you today. In our second hour, Carl Hart, chair of the Columbia University Psychology Department, is back with his latest research into what he calls drug use by grown-ups. You might have seen the news yesterday that the Biden administration is moving now to reclassify marijuana and ease restrictions. So the timing of this conversation with Carl Hart could not be more propitious. Look forward to our second hour. In our third hour today, two conversations. Up first, America's most visible death doula, Alua Arthur, joins us to explore how reframing our perspectives on death can help lead us to better lives, to more fulfilling lives, and more authentic lives. We look forward to that conversation at the top of our three, on the B side of our three, inclusion strategist Amber Cabral on teaching people to be good humans and shifting the narrative on DEI. Imagine that. Look forward to that dialogue on the backside of our three. So two good hours in front of us. But I am delighted today to commence the show with comedian, writer, producer, and actor Larry Wilmore. Before we get to Larry Wilmore, here we grow again. Here we grow again. I am pleased to welcome almost a dozen new affiliates to whom I am grateful for carrying this program. Give me a second to run this list, and we'll jump right into our dialogue with Larry Wilmore for the rest of the hour. Let me thank Milwaukee, Wisconsin, WNOV, 860 AM, 106.5 FM. Milwaukee, welcome. We love you. Detroit, Michigan, WGPR, 107.5. Thank you, Detroit. The Big D, Motown. Orlando, Florida, WHPB, 98.5 FM. Welcome. Muskegon, Michigan, WUVS, LP, 103.7 FM. Montgomery, Alabama, WUMO, 94.5. Natchez, Mississippi, the SIP is in the house. WMIS, 1240 AM, Jonesboro, Arkansas, KLEK, 102.5 FM, Albuquerque. Who says anybody listening in Albuquerque? Albuquerque, New Mexico. KMGG, 99.9 FM, Benton Harbor, Michigan. WVBH, LP, 105.3. Marshall, Texas, KBWC, 91.9 FM. And Flint, Michigan, WFOV, 92.1 FM. About a dozen stations there. New stations, adding the Tavis Smiley Show. And I am deeply grateful. I am humbled by all of these affiliates that are allowing us to expand this program across the country from California to the Carolinas. But if you note, listen to that list, we are expanding pretty aggressively now into swing states like Michigan and Wisconsin. Joe Biden can't pull this off without Michigan and Wisconsin, certainly not without Michigan, with all those electoral votes. And so it's going to be a fascinating year, as you well know. But I'm just, again, thrilled that so many stations all across the country, about a dozen today, adding the Tavis Smiley Show to their lineups. Thank you, thank you, thank you. As I said, I am humbled, and I am grateful. That said, now to Larry Wilmore. Insecure, Blackish, The Bernie Mac Show, Comedy Central, The PJs, pretty impressive, right? I could, of course, go on if I had the time, but that's enough to get us started. What a career, and he ain't done yet. Pleased to welcome Larry Wilmore to this program. Larry, how are you, sir?
Good. Thanks, Tavis. What a nice introduction. It's so nice to be here. By the way, on radio, how old school and cool is this, right?
Hey, we're still here. We're still here, Larry. We're still here.
I know. It's like, do people even have radios anymore? Like, how does this work? What is that thing with the sound where it comes out? What is that thing?
You know, what's amazing about that is that people joke about that all the time. And yet the data about this, right, Larry, is pretty incontrovertible. This probably won't surprise you, given that you're an old school guy as I am. Yeah. But radio is still still the preferred choice of African American listeners all across the country. All the podcasts, yeah. And by the way, we're doing a live program right now. When this program's done, we'll strip out the commercials right. And post it as a podcast. So we're on radio. We have a podcast. They're watching us right now on YouTube. You can listen on the app all around wow. The world. I mean, we're hitting people anywhere and everywhere they are to hear the audio content yeah. that we're providing. But it's fascinating that radio is still the way to reach African Americans in particular.
Well, we have a history of being connected to the radio culturally and that sort of thing. And we've had different, you know, DJs and hosts who've been, you know, connected to the community and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. It's a real rich history. I'm actually developing a show with Ludacris right now, kind of based on his early days as a DJ in Atlanta.
Oh, cool.
And some of the things he did. And it's really exciting to go back and remember those times, you know, like, you know, before, you know, podcasts and all that stuff mm-hmm. and the certain kind of controversies we're in today and what it was like when you were changing, when the game was changing back then. It's really fun.
Yeah. No, radio is alive and well, as evidenced by the dozen stations that we just mentioned, almost a dozen that are adding this program today. And again, I'm thankful to all those stations. Thankful to Larry Wilmore for the hour. There's a whole lot to unpack. I just mentioned some of the shows that he's produced and created. What a legacy in this business called Hollywood. But beyond that, he has had his a number of platforms, including his own podcast now, where he sounds off on the issues of the day. And I've got a few issues I want to put in front of him to take his temperature on. But speaking of radio, there would have been no civil rights movement as we know it had it not been for black radio. Dr. King didn't have a podcast. For that matter, never had a radio program. Didn't have an app. Didn't have a YouTube channel. Didn't have Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. And yet he taught the nation in that movement how to protest. And the only platform that he had available to him was black radio. So thank God for black radio. Just getting started with Larry Wilmore on Tavis Smiley.
From the Merck Park with love, this is Tavis Smiley. Helping to make you the most knowledgeable person in your circle of friends. This is Tavis Smiley.
This is Tavis Smiley in conversation with Larry Wilmore. Delighted to have him on. Television producer, actor, comedian, writer for more than 25 years. Currently heard as host of Larry Wilmore Black on the Air on the Ringer Podcast Network. But pleased to have him on this program today. Larry, I was walking the studio today trying to figure out where we'd even commence this conversation. There is so much news. There's so much breaking news. There's so much going on in the world. Let me just start with a broad question, and we'll jump from there. So I just heard you say crazy. What is your take on the world that we are inhabiting right about now? And we'll jump from there.
Well, you know, you always have turning points in history and that sort of thing, you know, and sometimes when you're inside of it, it's kind of hard to realize what's going on, but it certainly feels that way right now in a number of ways that mm-hmm. we're in some kind of transition in terms of how we view power, of how we view, you know, even our government, those types of things. Some of the things that are happening on both the right and the left are not just overturning and having different ideas about culture, you know, but different ideas about governing. I mean, this whole MAGA movement, you know, is based on the fact that, you know, Donald Trump actually wanted to change the votes. You know, I mean, it's crazy in that he feels aggrieved because of that, you know, and there's a whole grievance mentality that has nothing to do with policies or anything that has kind of taken over how we view government should be run. You know, it's really kind of scary that because it's outside of even regular partisan politics and how we view what a democracy is, whether we agree with policy or not. It's just different, you know. Mm-hmm. So that kind of worries me a lot. And our whole notion of allyship in the world is changing also. I mean, there was never a question that Israel was an ally, you know, and or that we were going to support a country against, let's say, Soviet Union or Russia. And now all that is thrown up, you know, is up for grabs now. You know, people are reexamining these things, you know, in ways no one could have predicted even a few years ago. You know, and who knows where that's going to go and what that's going to mean to the dynamics in the world. You know, mm-hmm. We know how important the Middle East is, not just to our country, but to the globe, you know, in many different ways, not just about
Israel and Palestine, there's a whole dynamic in that Middle East that is of strategic importance to not just us, but the rest of the world. So I look at kind of those macro issues, and you could go to the micro part of it too, which we all can relate to also. But the macro part, I mean, Tavis, this is definitely a shift right now that's happening that we're in the middle of, you know, and sitting right next to that is China, who's looking at it all going, yep, keep going. We'll see. I'm just going to sit over here and just, you know, just let all, like those James Bond movies, it's Spectre, you know, mm-hmm. you know, just let them fight it out. I'm just going to stay here and just see what happens in the end. So that's kind of my global kind of, you know, just look at it. I'm just really kind of fascinated by it. You know, I've been into history a lot the last few years, so I look at this kind of with the historical lens as well.
Let me go back to your initial thesis that you, where you suggested that it feels like we're in sort of some kind of transition. And I receive that. Mm-hmm. I accept that. I don't disagree with it. I guess the question, though, Larry, is what do you think we are transitioning to? I mean, this audience has been saying this all the time. I try to always mm-hmm. refer to this space that we live in called the U.S. of A. as an experiment mm-hmm. in democracy. I believe that we have a Madisonian right. framework for democracy, but we haven't quite mm-hmm. achieved that, never mind our intent and our behavior and our actions to try to spread democracy around the globe. We ain't perfected it yet here at home. I digress on that point mm-hmm. for now. But we're in this journey of this experiment, rather, of democracy. And so there are moments where we have to do these sort of check-ins to see, mm-hmm. I think, where we are in this particular journey. So when you say that it feels like we're in a transition, what's it feel like mm-hmm. for you that we're transitioning to, if that makes sense?
Well, let me point out two areas where the attacks on the democracy are happening in real time that, to me, are some of the things that help to protect the democracy.
Okay.
And that's both the press and what has been called just the institutional government, not the partisan government, but the institutional government, mm-hmm. or as the right calls it, the deep state.
The deep state, yeah.
Right, but what the deep state really is, let's start with that first. It's really institutional knowledge. It's people who are in the government all the time. They're separated from partisan politics, and they're the people who actually run the government, you know. And you need these people for their knowledge of how government works, of how systems work, of, you know, even relationships between countries and things like that. That's why we have certain nonpartisan roles in the government, you know, everything from the CIA to all kinds of things, right? So part of what the right has been doing, which I think is very destructive, is they have been attacking the institution as some partisan thing that is destroying government, when in fact they're dismantling one of the checks on government, mm-hmm. you know, and the other is the press. You know, the press is one of the things that freedom of the press, freedom of speech is another checks on out of control democracy. When you're free to speak about something and free to cover something, no matter what it is, from the right or the left or in the middle or whatever. Now, Trump attacking the press in the way he did, to me, has deteriorated our trust in the press more than anything that has ever done. And that deterioration means we don't know what to trust. Once you lose trust in the people who are delivering us what is supposed to be the truth, well, what are we going to count on as the truth? Mm. You know, what do we rely on, Tavis? Honestly, you know, you're left to just stay in your bubbles and be influenced by confirmation bias all the time, you know, things that are just feeding the things that you already believe to be true, rather than confronted with things that you may have a conflict with, because the truth doesn't care about your opinion.
Yeah, let me push back on that gently. This is getting good around here, as we say. This is getting good.
Sure.
Let me push back gently. I don't disagree with your thesis. I don't disagree with your analysis, but I do want to push back in this regard, if I can, Larry. I don't believe. Mm-hmm. Let me start with your latter point, and I'll work my way back. I don't believe as much as I used to that the media is ultimately about getting at the press, to use your term, is ultimately about getting at the truth as much as they are about profit. I am getting more and more concerned about the corporate media in this country. As you know, because of this monopolistic bent that we now have in this country, monopolistic bent, privatization, I could do this all day long. They're really just a handful of people who control pretty much everything we see and read. And I see that as a corporate media takeover that is more concerned about profit than it is about truth, number one. Number two, while I do believe that, you know, that you need an independent and free press, I just said yesterday on this program, quoting a great thinker, that any sort of war, the truth is always the first casualty, right? And so that's why Donald Trump is engaging his behavior. But speaking of Donald Trump, that you raised a moment ago, the media created Donald Trump. And I never want us to lose sight of that, because we're in a moment right now where they are hell-bent doing everything they can to destroy him, in some respects at least, and make sure that he doesn't get reelected. But this is the same media that created Donald Trump, that gave him all that free access to the airwaves. Bernie Sanders couldn't get a tenth as much exposure and press as Donald Trump did. We, the media, the press, created this monster. I told somebody the other day, I've said it more than once, that old adage that the media builds you up and they tear you down. Wrong. Get your conjunction right. The media builds you up to tear you down, not and tears you down. The point is, they making money coming and going. They're making money when they build you up. They're making money when they tear you down. So I'm not so sure I buy the argument that the press is not complicit in the creation of this monster called Donald Trump.
Well, certainly the press is complicit in that, but also Donald Trump, you can argue, manipulated the media. You know, it's not like he was some innocent that was just sitting somewhere. You know,
is the media that gullible? Are we that gullible? Are we that stupid that he played us?
Well, sure.
There's that part. Okay.
Why would that not be a thing? I mean, the media always follows the shiny object. When has the media not followed the shiny object?
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But media, the media is more than just like the television media, like what you would call CNN. And I think CNN more than anything did it. Look, I hosted the White House Correspondents' Dinner in Obama's last one, and I went after things like Morning Joe. I critiqued them for their coverage on Trump and some of that stuff. So I was doing that in real time to people's face about that before he was president, and predicted he was going to be president. You know, so I agree with you on that. But there's print journalism. There's all kinds of other journalism that is part of the media. When I say media, you know, and when I talk about the Fourth Estate and its role in the check on democracy, you know, that it has a long-standing role. And sure, there's this symbiotic, you know, relationship. Look, the movie network predicted a lot of this in terms of television news and, you know, and when it became a profit center rather than, you know, people acknowledged that they were going to lose money on the news, but they didn't care. Yeah. But when it became part of the entertainment division, you know, it became something else. And by the way, you know, Roger Ailes and his creation of Fox News changed things dramatically, you know, where then it was really a race to ratings and what you could do. And that's what changed CNN in many ways, where CNN was way more respected before they had a competitor than when they did, you know, which is kind of crazy also, you know.
Yeah.
So anyhow, yes, I would agree with you that it is more layered than just, you know, this. It's not just these justice warriors in the media. I agree with that. You know, who are doing God's work, and we should just bless them all the time.
No, I just think I don't want us to ever be in a mindset that I think is too oversimplistic. And I take your point. As I said earlier, I disagree with it for the most part. It is objectionable to me on so many fronts that Donald Trump has attacked and continues to attack the media the way he does. But I don't think the media has clean hands in this. I think they're complicit. I think they created this individual, this monster. And so I digress on that, but I want to just add that to the conversation.
I will say this. Let me push back a little bit too,
because
they can't create a monster without a monster constituency.
You know? Agreed.
People have to support Trump. There has to be a simpatico out there.
Yeah.
The avatar that Trump is the avatar for the culture war. That's what he's the avatar for. Is the media? The media just aired that to everybody, you know.
Yeah.
But it's not like you could say he created Trump, but they didn't create the followers. You know, those people were waiting for someone like Trump who could stand up to the left and not be bullied by what they thought was, and overturning of their culture, quote unquote,
yeah.
from the left. So a lot of what Trump represents is not so much policy, like I was saying, in normal political terms, but to me, it's cultural.
Mm-hmm.
It's who's the culture warrior as president that people want to get behind, and that's Donald Trump. It's certainly not Joe Biden.
Yeah. Speaking of the media, the press, and Donald Trump, you might have seen your friend Jon Stewart. A couple weeks ago, you were obviously a part of the Daily Show. We'll talk about that as we move through this hour. But John went in on the media for the way they're covering Trump all over again. And his point, if I can put it in a nutshell, is have we really learned anything? I mean, we're doing this all over again. His point was that they're turning the media into OJ again, right? The media is turning Trump, rather, into this sort of OJ spectacle again. We're watching this guy go in court and come out of court and this and that. I mean, let's focus on what's being said and done in the courtroom, but they're at it again, creating this spectacle, the comings and the goings, and Stewart went in a way that I don't need to try to, replicate what he said,
sure.
but you take my point. And so the question is whether or not you think the media has learned anything about how to cover this guy?
Probably not. I mean, Jeff Zucker was running it back then, and he ran NBC, and so he, was more interested in the entertainment part of it. I always say, CNN, every story is breaking news, It's like everything, It's like, hey, it's 12 o'clock, breaking news.
Breaking news.
12 o'clock, Yeah, it's like, after a while, they literally are breaking news.
Yeah.
They've broken it. You broke it, CNN. Congratulations.
Wow.
You did it.
Wow.
So look, I get part of that. I will respectfully disagree with John. I think John is missing some of the point, like I said, about the constituency. There's a reason why Trump has so many people at his rallies. It's not because he's on television, for Christ's sakes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, because why can't they do that for anybody? Mm-hmm. Joe Biden's on TV a lot. Why don't they feel the same way?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that easy of a thing. It's like when people were saying, because Obama was elected, how these votes, any black person could be president now. It's like, well, no, that's, We would have ran a long time ago. We would have done this a long time ago if this was the case. Obama had followers, people who followed his charisma and the message and all of that stuff,
Yeah.
But I think John underestimates the reason why people are behind Trump. It's not because he's on TV a lot.
Yeah.
That is very shallow as far as I'm concerned.
Nope. I take your point. And I respect the pushback. Just wanted to get your temperature on what John had to say. And now that I've done that, let me move forward. And when we come forward, I was just thinking, as Larry was talking, if you were, visiting here from another planet or something, you heard this first half hour, you would think this guy was just, his day job is being a political pundit. He obviously is well-versed. He's well-read. He has his own opinions. But you wouldn't necessarily know this is the same guy that helped bring us Insecure and Blackish and the Bernie Mac Show and the PJs and so much more I could talk about. So we'll do that part when we come forward. I'm curious as to how he sees his role as, I would use this term to describe him, a citizen artist. He may like that, may not, we'll see. But I think he's a citizen artist. And there are a lot of artists who don't want to touch the stuff that Larry Wilmore and I were just talking about. So we'll talk about the way he sees his role in the world. We'll talk about his artistic genius and more when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
Unapologetically progressive. Unapologetically black. You're tapped into Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley. Smiley.
Made fresh daily in the Mert Park,
Los Angeles, California.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley.
You're listening to Tavis Smiley and Larry Wilmore, the producer and actor, comedian and writer. Just a distinguished career. People in this town are envious. Envious of anybody who's had the kind of career that Larry Wilmore has had, and he ain't done. You heard him mention earlier in this program, in case you've just tuned in, he's working on a project now with Ludacris. So he's doing, he's as busy as ever, but I want to just pause at this point in his career to acknowledge and to celebrate what he has done and the duality of the roles that he has played. I said a moment ago, and Larry can respond in a moment and push back or accept it, but I see Larry and a few other people I know in this town as what I would call citizen artists. They are not afraid to inhabit the first part of that that nomenclature any more than they're afraid to accept and to lean into the second part, the artist part. But then there are other folk in this town who don't want anything to do with politics. They want to just do their art. They want to please everybody. I'm thinking now of Michael Jordan, who I obviously love and respect, but he and I had a conversation about this many years ago. I didn't like it when they asked him why he wouldn't endorse Harvey Gantt in the race against Jesse Helms, this white supremacist obstructionist out of North Carolina who was being challenged by Harvey Gantt, the black mayor of Charlotte, North Carolina. And they asked Michael Jordan why he wouldn't endorse Harvey Gantt. And he said, Republicans buy tennis shoes, too. I ain't forgot that all these years later. Republicans buy tennis shoes, too. Well, that may be true, but it's Jesse Helms, Michael. It's Jesse Helms. And there's a brother who has a chance of beating him and sitting in the United States Senate. Again, Michael is entitled, as all the rest of us, to the way we see the world and our role in it, which just is a preface to ask Larry Wilmore how, Larry Wilmore, you see your role in the world, because you occupy both of those spaces. You speak out as a citizen, and you're clearly an artistic genius.
Oh, thanks, Tez. It's so nice of you. You know, it's kind of just who I am. I've always been into the news and current events. I remember watching Walter Cronkite with my mom, and I remember my grandmother was big into that type of stuff. One of the biggest honors of my career, I won the Peabody for Bernie Mac Show, and Walter Cronkite gave me the award. It was amazing.
Wow.
And yeah, of course I had to make a joke about it at the time too, but it was just, you know, a full circle. But yeah, I've always kind of connected those, and I always try to, even the PJs, we have political comments in that show that, you know, that were challenging. Bernie Mac, not so much. It was more of a family show, but my political statement was, yeah, this is an intact black family, you know, and it's okay that they have abundance. Like, abundance is okay. We don't have to, you know, have non-abundance, which is always the black story too, you know, like we can live in abundance too. I did a special for Netflix called Amend a couple of years ago about the 14th Amendment that I did with Will Smith. And, you know, that one, you know, I had never done a docudrama before, a documentary, not docudrama. But just the things I learned from doing it, you know, so it helps me too. It's not just giving out things to other people, but I'm passionate about it, Tavis, and it's something that I enjoy doing more so than I think it's a duty, you know. So I think that's kind of why it's, you know, something I've done for a long time.
Yep. I want to run through just a few things. I've mentioned them already, and there are any number of other things I could mention. As I said earlier, if I had the time, I could just I could spend 3 hours just running your credits, man, and I ain't got 3 hours to do that.
But, I'll mention this one. Reasonable Doubt is a show on Hulu that I'm producing with Kerry Washington right now. We're doing our second season, but people, watch the first season. It's a fun show. We got a great second season coming up.
It's on my list. Let me start with that then, since you went there first, because I want to just walk through these and just get you just some basic thoughts and reflections on some of these things. But first, tell me about Reasonable Doubt for those who've not seen it on Hulu.
Well, Reasonable Doubt, it's more of kind of like your soapy legal drama is a good way to explain it. It's more in Kerry Washington's wheelhouse than mine. But I had always wanted to, I'm a big fan of Kerry's, and when I had a deal at Disney, she was over there, and we just met and wanted to do something together. And this is loosely based on Sean Holly, who was actually in the legal team of the O.J. Simpson trial, which you mentioned earlier, the original one. And Sean is like, she's defended many celebrities and everything. It's very high profile cases. And so we wanted to do a show loosely based on her. We actually did a network version that didn't go, that was more based on her. But then we kind of rejiggered it for streaming. And now it's just kind of loosely based on her, you know. Yeah. So I want to make that distinction because there's a lot of things in here that aren't Sean that she was, hey, wait a minute, I never did that, you know, because this show is, it's sexy, it's thrilling. The first season, you know, had an interesting storyline, but the second season we're dealing with domestic violence and some issues that are really, you know, very provocative and leads to some really interesting storylines that we hadn't even counted on. But it's really a lot of fun, so I hope people can catch it.
Now, I know Sean, and she has distinguished herself in this town, representing, as you said, a lot of high profile clients. I mean, she got that Puffy case right now, so she's speaking for Puffy right now as one of his his attorneys.
I don't know if she's still on.
Is she off that case now? Right, okay, now.
I think so. Okay. She was on a very certain
piece of it.
Segment
yeah.
of it.
Sure.
You know. Yeah. Exactly. Well, yeah, there you go. That's the kind of thing that she's not afraid to.
Yeah.
I mean, that's some dicey stuff, Tavis.
Yeah, it is very dicey. And so let me just say, since we're on the record here, and this is public, whatever her role is or was, she was at some point speaking for Puffy in the last couple months. And
right.
I'll leave it at that.
Right.
I don't know what this current situation is. Yeah, we'll leave it at that.
Right.
You mentioned the Bernie Mac show. I love Bernie. I miss Bernie. Bernie and I hung out. Of course, had him on my programs any number of times. But I miss Bernie even all these years later. Just say a word to me, since you were there with the Bernie Mac show. Just say a word about Bernie.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Bernie, so at the time I was doing the show, I really wanted to do something different. You know, it's where the Bernie Mac show started. It started with just wanting to do something that was form different. And that's why it looks the way it looks. I won't go into detail about that. But when I saw Bernie on Kings of Comedy and talked about taking care of his wife's kids and everything, I mean, not his wife's kids, his sister's kids.
He wants some milk and cookies. He got some milk and cookies.
Exactly. It was so funny. I thought, man. And then he dared Hollywood to make his story. I go, I'll make a story. And I had met Bernie before and I called him and pitched it to him. But when I was developing the show, I spent some time with Bernie. I went to Chicago and I hung out with him and some of his friends. I interviewed his friends. I wanted to know what he was like, you know, back in the day, how he had changed maybe. I went to Vegas with him and I saw his relationship with fans, you know, and people loved him, Tavis. Like they would come, they treated Bernie like he was a member of their family. Mm-hmm. And by the way, Bernie treated them the same way. That's what was special about Bernie, because I know many, and I'm not going to mention names, but there were a couple of other comedians. Well, people get to guess who it is now at this point. But who were the opposite of that? They were the opposite of that. If you looked at them, it was like you killed one of their kids. It's like, what did I do? You know? But it's like all I did was look at you. But Bernie, he would go up to them. They would say, "Hey, Bernie Mac." He'd say, "Hey, man, how you doing? You know, how's it going?" And it made Tavis. It would make their day. You know. And I was so impressed by that. I was like, wow, you know, Bernie's not kidding around. When you talk about someone who's really a man of the people, he really had that relationship. And you see it in his act. The way, if you go back to Kings of Comedy, the way the audience responds to Bernie is different.
Oh, yeah.
It's just different from everybody else. And there's a reason for that. He's really connected to that audience. And it taught me about authenticity, too, you know, where it's like was trying to do it up to that point, but it really brought it home in a different way, like being authentic with your audience and being in that relationship for real and not having a wall between you and the audience, you know, that type of thing.
Now, as I said earlier, Larry Wilmore has done it big, and he's still doing it big. He's doing it big now with Kerry Washington on Reasonable Doubt on Hulu. He mentioned earlier his project he's working on with Ludacris. We just talked, obviously, about Bernie Mac and the Bernie Mac show. When we come forward, let's talk about Insecure and Issa Rae. Let's talk about Black-ish and that amazing cast. As I said, people in this town are envious of a career like the one that Larry Wilmore has fashioned. More with him when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
This is getting good. Tavis Smiley continues when we come forward. Let's get back to more of this rich dialogue with Tavis Smiley.
More of this rich dialogue with Larry Wilmore, who we're pleased to have on this program today in our first hour. Larry, we talked about the Bernie Mac show. I want to talk about Black-ish. As I sit here, I mean, I don't do what you do. I don't occupy your space. But if I did, I'd be awfully jealous and envious of you, because it's one thing to have a career where you get one major touchstone. You get one major project that people talk about. Mm-hmm. It runs in syndication. It moves and pushes the culture forward. But to do that multiple times, it just ain't right. It's just cosmically unfair. It's cosmically unfair, Larry Wilmore, to be able to touch that many projects. But talk to me in reflection now about Black-ish and what that show you think meant and will mean in the years to come.
Well, sure. I'll combine it with Insecure, because I was developing Insecure with Issa in that summer before we did the pilot of Black-ish. And it was called Nonprofit at the time. PROPHET, actually, was the original name of that. And we had done like maybe six drafts of that thing, and a little frustrated. HBO, the process takes really a long time. And in the meantime, ABC had called and said, "Hey, we really like this script, Black-ish, but, you know, can you he's kind of, you know, he hasn't really run a show before, and we need somebody to kind of help supervise the pilot. Would you be willing to do that? And I was like, oh, let me take a look at the script. And I read it, and page one, I was like, oh, man, this thing is fantastic. And I go, I'm like, this is, and it was hilarious. It was bold, and it was in your face, and it, like, unabashedly just embraced the culture in a way that was not on television at the time, you know. And so I met with Kenyon and helped do the pilot and helped develop that show. And in the meantime, I was offered my own show at Comedy Central, the nightly show, mm-hmm. you know, which was a once-in-a-lifetime type of thing. So I had to leave Black-ish. I stayed there for about 6 months to help launch that first season. Mm-hmm. And I stayed as a consultant for Insecure, which really hadn't been picked up yet. We hadn't even shot a pilot. We didn't know what was going to happen with that. So all those three things happened at once. But Black-ish from the beginning, it's Kenya's take on the Black family and where we are right now. And just the role of parenting and kids, like authenticity. What is Black? What isn't Black? Are you Black enough? Are you my kids? Oh, no, my kids are Black-ish. They're not even Black. Like, you know, just the value we put on that. That was a new statement. Nobody had ever done that, you know. Mm-hmm. But we also knew at the time that we had to balance that with a family show, which is what the network was very – the network was – they were kind of concerned about it, you know, relying so much on its premise. In fact, they wanted to change the title of it, you know. And we went through this whole thing of trying to come up with different titles. And I would always come up with titles that I knew they would reject. You know, that was always my strategy. <You know? laughs> I mean, that's how you have to do it sometimes.
I got 45 seconds. We'll continue when we come forward. The strategy in picking titles that you know they would reject is what? What's that strategy?
Because we need them. They're going to see how great it's. Title Black-ish is, you know.
Yeah.
I learned this from Bernie Mac's show, where Bernie was concerned about using his own name. He said, man, I don't want to use my name. And in my mind, I'm like, are you kidding me? There's no better name than Bernie Mac. So I did a version of the script, Travis, where it said Bernie Man. Mm-hmm. Like, I gave him a horrible name. It was just terrible, Bernie Man. And he read that script and he hated it. He said, no, man, let's use my name. And I'm like, yes, let's use your name. Your name is awesome.
I get it. I get it. There's a method to your madness. I get it now. When we come forward in our remaining moments with Larry Wilmore, he said that the original name of the show was Nonprofit, spelled like the prophet, right? Yeah, Nonprofit. I wonder where that came from and why it didn't survive. Our remaining moments with Larry Wilmore when we come forward on Tavis Smiley.
More of Tavis Smiley when we come forward.
Sounds different. This is Tavis Smiley.
Tavis Smiley and Larry Wilmore in these final 3 minutes. I've enjoyed this immensely, but the time is coming to a close. Larry Wilmore, tell me about Nonprofit. What did that come from and why didn't it stick?
Well, you know, it's kind of how shows work. You develop names and stuff. I always like to distill whatever show is down to a simple idea, simple sentence. Like Bernie Mac's show was, kids are terrorists, I don't negotiate with terrorists, right? Like that was what the show was mm-hmm. in a simple thing. And Insecure in the beginning was really about someone who didn't know who she was or where she was going. That was kind of mm-hmm. what we were working with. And if you remember the show Girls, was on HBO at the time, and Lena Dunham,
you know,
proclaimed herself the voice of a generation or something, you know. Mm-hmm. And this show was kind of the opposite. This girl's a nonprofit, you know. She had no proclamations to make to anyone, let alone to herself, you know. This is somebody trying to figure things out, someone who's overqualified in a nothing job, you know. And it was more representative of some of the angst that her generation was feeling and that sort of thing. So that's kind of what Nonprofit came out of that. Like, yeah, but Insecure, yeah, after I was doing my own thing and Issa wrote a couple of drafts, it became more of an ensemble type of thing. Mm-hmm. And Insecure more represented her character a little bit more than Nonprofit was. Yeah. So I think that's why it changed.
I love the title, Nonprofit. I just wanted to, now that you've explained it, I understand why it was created and how it could have worked, although I like Insecure. It works.
Me too. I think Insecure is better.
In these last 90 seconds, not that you need more work to do, but I want to just put something on your docket. I am craving some more smart Black animation, Larry Wilmore.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well,
let's hope something comes our way.
Yeah.
I mean, I did that. I already did that. I'm not going backwards, Tavis. I'm going forward. So
no,
I'm looking to do new things for, you know, us to do, not go back and visit old ones.
No, I ain't mad at you. He has, as he said, he's been there, done that, got the T-shirt. But I really am craving some more smart black animation. I love that stuff.
And I understand.
Yeah, Larry did it well. Of course, everything Larry does, he does well. Whether it's Insecure or Blackish or the Brennan Mac Show or his show on Comedy Central, the PJs, Reasonable Doubt with Kerry Washington, the Ludicrous Project forthcoming, and whatever else is forthcoming on his docket. Larry, thank you for your work. And I use this phrase a lot, but I think it applies to you. Thank you for your work and your witness. I'll leave it at that, your work and your witness. And it's good to have had you on this program. Thank you for the time, sir.
Thank you, Tavis. It's nice to hear you out there on the old school radio.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. More of Tavis Smiley on old school radio when we come forward.